I want to start with a Jude update. We started feeding him some baby food the other night for the first time. It was a lot of fun. Avery made some homemade, I think she like roasted a banana and then mashed it all up and then put a little bit of cinnamon on it and let him try it. And he loves it. So that was a great thing. But what was even better is that it filled his stomach up to the point where he slept 11 hours that night. Yeah, that's worth praising right there. Yes. And so anyway, we're feeling good. It's been a good time lately. So with that in mind, on that positive note, I do want to start by sharing one of mine and Avery's favorite memories as a couple together. So you're going to get in on some of our favorite memories this morning. And this was when we went to the movies together. We love to go to the movies. That was one of the things when we were dating that we liked to do. And so this particular movie that we were going to go see was the X-Men movie called Days of Future Past. How many of you saw that movie? Yeah, okay, so there's some of you. How many of you know what X-Men are? All right, I'm not going to ask how many of you are clueless. That's a pretty good amount, though, so I won't single out those who don't know. But for those who don't know what X-Men are, they are basically superheroes. Those who are extremely nerdy hate that because they're actually called mutants, right? But it's people with special powers. Now, this movie is called Days of Future Past, so what do you think it deals with? Right? Like, it's time travel, it's time hopping, there's different things that were happening, right? And it's Days of Future Past. And so, this movie, Avery and I are going to see. I'm more excited probably than she is, but we both like movies, so we were enjoying it, you know, and it was going to be a good time. And we get there, we're about 5 minutes late. And so we knew, like, the movie's probably already started at this point. Of course, I actually think we were, like, 20 minutes late, but we calculated it would actually be only 5 minutes of the movie because 15 minutes of previews, right? So we know we're going to come in, and the movie's already started. And so we walk in, and we sit down, and we start. Of course, the movie's going, and there's this big fight going on. No problem, you know? And so we're watching, and I'm watching, and Avery's like, what's happening? And I was like, I think it's just one of those movies where they flash to the end and show you what happens at the end, you know, at the beginning. And then they go back and do this whole movie that leads up to the end, and then you watch it again at the real ending. Does that make sense? And so we're watching and we're seeing this happen. About 20 minutes into this fight, I'm starting to get suspicious of what's going on as I'm seeing some villains that I know are big villains dying. And I'm like, And then I'm noticing some of the heroes that are dying. And I'm going, this isn't right. We shouldn't be seeing this yet. And I look over at Avery and she goes, what is going on? I said, I don't know. Check our movie ticket. Are we in the right theater? And she looks and she goes, no, we're in the wrong theater. And so we pick up our stuff and we're like, go, go, go. And so we go out and then we go and find our theater. Well, now it's like 45 minutes into the movie, Days of Future Past, and we've seen the ending but have missed the beginning. And so we start in the middle, and we watch all the way through to the ending, and by the time the movie's over, we look at each other and go, what happened? And neither one of us know. And so we're laughing and we're having a good time, but we're like, all right, this was horrible, a terrible experience. It's just a fail, you know, and so we're walking out, and we notice that there is another theater. And we hear that it's in the previews, but it's playing the same movie. So we're like, well, let's go in. And so then we go into the same movie again, hoping to catch the beginning. And so we do. We're like, yes, we did it. We're about to finally see the beginning. So maybe it will all make sense. And as the movie starts, we realize it's 3D and we don't have 3D glasses. It was honestly the most confusing movie I've ever been a part of in my life, right? A movie about time travel, and you watch it completely backwards. End, then middle, and then beginning in 3D, and you can hardly see what's going on, right? So sometimes, though, I feel like that's how life can be, right? Like, sometimes I feel like I'm working towards the end, I'm living in the middle, but I have no idea what God did at the beginning. Like, how did I get here? Why am I here? What are you doing? I just can't figure it out. You ever feel that way? And so then I got to thinking, with the topic of superheroes, about if I could have one superpower, what would it be? What if you could have one superpower, what would you choose? And so used to, back in the day when I was younger and more immature, I would choose something like flying, because I thought that was really cool. But now that I've grown up and matured a lot more, I've realized that I would choose something way more adult. I would see the future, right? I would love to see the future. I think that would be the coolest superpower. But I in all seriousness, would like to see the future because I often worry about the future. Am I the only one who struggles with that? Like, I worry about our country and our nation and the unity that we have. I wonder if we can ever be a nation that will again come together for a common cause and a common purpose. Sometimes I worry. Sometimes I worry about the faith community as a whole. I worry about Christians, and are we going to continue to live into what we know is the main thing, or are we going to continue to get distracted by other things? I worry about sickness. I worry about sick friends of mine and sick family members of mine and people who have the cancer is eating people up, and it scares me. I worry about the health emotionally, mentally, physically, and spiritually of family and friends of mine. I would choose the superpower to see the future because it would help me to eliminate the unknown. And you know what? It would help make waiting on God a lot easier, wouldn't it? I can be patient because I know how it ends, and so I can wait around because I can see what's going to happen here. But it's really hard to be still and to trust in God and to have faith today when I don't have confidence in tomorrow. I would choose to see the future, to know why God does what he does, to know how things are going to work out, to know how the story is going to end. And you know what? Seeing the future, I think, would help me with my daily struggle of doubt that I have in myself. You know, I wonder a lot, how am I going to be as a dad? Am I going to be a good father? Am I going to be the kind of husband that Avery deserves me to be? Then I start to think, you know, what about my ministry? How effective is my ministry going to be? Am I actually going to make a difference? Will the Spirit work through the ministry? And then I think, you know, how, or better yet, will I ever get out of student loan debt? You know? And if I could just see the future, it would help me to live in confidence today. But it's hard to live in confidence today when I can't see what's going to happen tomorrow. Am I the only one struggling with that? Or do y'all feel it too? That if we knew how the story would end for tomorrow, we could live with more confidence today. So I'm going to jump right into the deep end this morning. No wading around. You know, you ever go to a pool and you want to stick your toes in and kind of feel it and then kind of ease in? We're not going to do that this morning. We're going to dive right into the deep end from the beginning. So here is the application of the day. The one thing I want for you to take home through this lesson. Here it is. If you're a note taker, here it is. Confidence is found not in seeing the future. Confidence is found in shifting your perspective off of what you cannot see onto who you can see. I'm going to say it again. Confidence is found in shifting your perspective off of what you can't see and onto who you can see. And so the question that we're asking oftentimes, you and I, as we struggle with this doubt and fear of what's going to happen in the future, our question in dealing with that is the wrong question. That's what I'm proposing this morning. We need to stop asking how and start asking who. We have the three letters right. We just need to shift the order around, right? It's not how is it going to work out? How is this going to happen? What's going to happen? It's who is in control of that future. And by the way, church, we're not the only ones who have struggled with this doubt and worry of the future, okay? There are many people who have struggled with this. Christians who have struggled with this. Think about Job for a second. Right? Job was constantly, especially at the beginning. Now, look, I commend Job. Obviously, Job was a man of great faith, great integrity. Even when everyone else, including his family and friends, were telling him to curse God and die, Job kept his integrity. He was a great man. But Job was asking the wrong question. He didn't lose faith, but he didn't have the right frame of mind through the whole situation. And so Job is constantly asking, well, how could God do this to me? How could God do this? Why do I deserve this? What did I do to deserve this? Actually, Job was so set on his ways. Remember, he wants to take God to a courtroom, and he's wanting to put him on trial and ask him questions. God, how could you do this to me? And then his friends and his wife are also focused on the wrong question, saying, you must have done something. How could this have happened to you? There must be something. But as the story unfolds, I love this, God eventually has enough of it. And he's not angry about Job's attitude as much as I think he's angry about the wrong perspective and the wrong question that Job's been asking. Everyone's asking questions through the book of Job, but they're all asking the wrong question. And so God comes and puts this huge storm together and comes in the middle of this storm, this hurricane-type storm, and begins to speak to Job. And what he does is he reminds Job of who he is. He doesn't explain how it all is going to work out and how and why he did what he did. He told Job who he was, because God expected the focus of who he was to be enough. But oftentimes that's really hard for us, isn't it? Because sometimes I would rather focus on how it'll work out before I focus on who God is. But God wanted to shift that perspective in Job. And so in this book, listen to Job's response. This is Job chapter 42, verses 1 through 6. And this is after God has just come in this storm. And Job's response is this. Job chapter 42, starting in verse 1. Then Job replied to the Lord, I know that you can do all things, and that no plan of yours can be thwarted. Now, that's a great way to start when you're talking to the Lord Almighty, right? Especially after what Job's just experienced. Hey, I know that you can do all things. No plan of yours can be thwarted. You asked, who is it that obscures my counsel without knowledge? Surely I spoke of things I do not understand. Things that were too wonderful for me to know. You said, listen now and I will speak. I will question you, and you will answer me. So God comes in and he says, I'm tired of all of your questions. I'm going to come, I'm going to speak, and I'm going to ask you some questions now. And then Job says in verse 5, and this is the key verse, a verse that I've missed, that I didn't have the appreciation for until this week. Listen to it. Job says, my ears had heard of you, but now my eyes have seen you. I had heard of you. I had come to church and talked about you. I had heard lessons about how great and powerful and wonderful you were. I had heard about you, but now my eyes have seen you. And when my eyes are open to who you are, my perspective for my future, past, and present change. And then in verse 6, he says, therefore, I despise myself and I repent in dust and ashes. I love that section, how my eyes have seen you. And I think it sets up exactly the rest of what I want to talk about this morning, which we are continuing our series on miracles this week. And we are on number 6 of 7 miracles. And this miracle is about the healing of a man who was born blind. And the text is John chapter 9, so you can go ahead and flip there. We'll be there shortly. John chapter 9. But this is a story of a man born blind, and so I want to approach it a little differently because I've preached sermons on the man born blind. I preached a sermon on blind Bartimaeus in the past, and so we're familiar with the miracle. It is an amazing miracle when God can restore the sight of someone. But I want to focus on something a little bit different in the text that I saw this week that really jumped out at me. But this is the miracle of the man where Jesus comes to him and he spits in the mud. You know, and then he picks up the mud, and our commentators, is it mud or is it clay? You know, but they pick it up, and he puts it on the man's eyes. He's like mud cakes over his eyes, and then tells him to go wash in the pool of salami, you know? No, it's not salami, it's loam. But he tells him, go wash, and then when he washes it, then he can see. That's always been weird to me. That why did God spit in the mud? Like that is so, it's kind of funky, you know? I mean, whatever, Jesus. Now, here's the other thing. When you start to read the scriptures, it might not actually seem that weird because there's been other miracles that Jesus has performed. In Matthew, he healed two men. He touched their eyes. Remember that? He healed those men and he just reached out and he touched them. But then in Mark, I believe is where it is, he just spit right in the eyes. I mean, okay. Whatever you want to do, Jesus. This time he spits in the mud and puts the mud and puts the clay on. And I was trying to figure out, why does Jesus change up his method so much? Like, if I'm going to heal a blind person, I'm just going to keep doing the same thing over and over again, right? But Jesus changes it up over and over again. Why? Does he need to do it? I don't think so. I think that he wants us to focus on the message of the healing over the method of the healing. And so he wanted us to understand, it doesn't matter how I do this. I can do it in several ways. It's not about how I'm doing it. It's about who is doing it. It's, again, the shift off of the question of how and onto the question of who. It's not about how I'm doing it, but it's about who is doing it. So as the story continues, this man is healed. A man, by the way, is born blind. He was blind from birth, and he's healed in a miraculous way. And the crowd starts to argue and gets kind of frustrated and is going, how did this happen? And so then they take him to the Pharisees, and the Pharisees start to put him on trial, the man who was healed. And they're putting him on trial and starting to question him and interrogate him and ask him, how did this happen? And then his family's brought in for proof. And so they bring in we don't believe that you were actually born blind. We think you could have seen the whole time. And so they bring in his parents, and they're going to question him. Was your son really blind? Oh, yeah, this is our son. He was blind. But as to how, we don't know how it happened. We don't know who did it. And so even the parents are asking the wrong question. And so I want us to look at that for just a second. Because a pattern throughout the Gospel of John is sight. The key theme through the Gospel of John is that we will believe, and by believing we'll have life in his name. That's why he's written the miracles that he's written, is so that we will believe. But another theme, as you read through it, you're going to see a lot of sight, a lot of seeing, a lot of miracles for blindness. You see the disciples in the boat when Jesus comes walking on the water, and what they saw, they thought they saw a ghost. It's just constantly this seeing, this sight shows up over and over again. And here's the thing, here's this pattern. Jesus does a miracle, and the Pharisees miss it, and the disciples are usually slow to get it, but the one who the miracle was performed on is typically the one who got it. Isn't that crazy? The religious people missed it, the disciples missed it, but the boy with a sack lunch of five loaves of bread and two fish, he gets it. It's kind of almost insulting, the people who get it versus the people who miss it. Remember Jesus said, he asked them, how are we going to feed these people? And he said, I'm asking you to test you. It's a test of your faith. And the disciples failed. But the boy gave all that he had in the hands of the Lord. And so here we step in, and the Pharisees miss it again. Now, I want to highlight something in particular. I want you to see if you notice this pattern as well. This miracle, the reason I had to set it up like this, it's 41 verses. I'm not going to read you 41 verses, okay? But I want to highlight something that I saw throughout. I think you'll like it too. So if you're an underliner, I actually am not, but I did underline what I'm about to show you. So I think it's worth it. Look at verse 2 of chapter 9. His disciples, we can start in verse 1. As he went along, he saw a blind man from birth, and his disciples asked Jesus, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? And so the disciples come to Jesus and they ask a question, but I don't think it's the right question to be asking. This question is wrapped in bad theology. Well, this man has a physical ailment, therefore he must have sinned. This was a belief that was carried through tradition for many, many thousands of years. If you look at Ezekiel chapter 18, they believed that sin was carried over from the father to the sons. And so it was this constant thing, and they're still struggling with this bad theology. And because of the bad theology, it's caused them to ask a bad question. Is there an answer to the question? Yes, but it's a bad question in the first place. So the disciples are asking this wrong question. Look at verse 10. Now, this is the people in the crowd after the miracles happened, and they say, well, how then were your eyes opened? How? So the first one is, who sinned? The next question I see in this text is, how? And then in verse 12, look at this. Where is this man? They asked him. Where is he? And they're asking because they want to go find him, and they want to have a talking with him, right? Because I don't like what you did on the Sabbath. Why did Jesus do so many miracles on the Sabbath? Did he have to do it on the Sabbath? I think he was trying to prove a point, folks. And so here again, the people are looking, where is he? Verse 15. Look at this. Therefore, they finally brought him to the Pharisees. Now listen to the Pharisees. The Pharisees also asked him how he received his sight. Verse 16. Some of the Pharisees said, this man is not from God, for he does not keep the Sabbath. But others asked, how can a sinner do a miraculous sign? Do you see this pattern forming in this text? 41 verses, tons of questions. Look at verse 17. Finally, they turned again to the blind man. What have you to say about him? Then you look at verse 19. Is this your son, they asked? Is this the one you say was born blind? How is it that he can now see? Again, the wrong question. Look at verse 21. This is the parents. But how he can see now, or who opened his eyes? They finally said the right word. Who? Who opened his eyes? But they're doing it in the wrong mentality. They're not actually asking who opened his eyes. They're defending themselves. How he did it, or who opened his eyes, we have no idea. Don't blame us. He's a grown man, ask him himself. That's what they say. You go ask him himself and he can answer you. Because we don't know, don't pull us into this. Thanks, Mom. Thanks, Dad. Now look at verse 26. Can you believe these questions keep going? I've never noticed this before I started to study this week. These questions just kept popping up. Questions are asked all through this text and none of them are the right question. Look, verse 26. Then they asked him, what did he do to you? How did he open your eyes? They're so focused on Jesus. How are you going to do this? And so often that's my question, right? God, if I could just see the future and see how you're going to do this, how will you open my eyes? How will you take care of me? How will I be as a father? How will my ministry be? How will this country turn out? How and when and in what way will COVID finally go away completely? When will we stop being able to wear masks and have other sections sectioned off and people separated and we can't go to church? When will all of this be over? When will our nation unify and come together for a common cause? How is it? You know, I've got a lot of questions I would love to ask God. Are you with me? There's a lot of questions I could ask him, and I could go on and on and on. And yet that's exactly what these people did. And not a single one were asking the right question. And I think oftentimes we miss that question too. And it's not that we don't have faith, but it's that a lot of times we let our fear trump our faith. Our fear drives our faith. But we've got to allow our faith to control our fear if we want to be successful and prosperous. And so verse 34, I love this. Look at the conclusion of the Pharisees. So after there's this whole convoluted thing, they're all talking about it. How did it happen? Where did he go? What happened? Where? Who? How? And all this is going on. And finally, here's the conclusion. I love it that the Pharisees come to at the end. To this, they replied, you were steeped in sin at birth. How dare you lecture us? And then they threw him out. Right? So like they're complaining, they're trying to figure it out, and finally they said, we know how, you were at sin from birth, that's all it was, get out of here, we're done. And the whole time they never even asked the right question, and now they're done, they've solved it themselves. The reason I want to highlight that is because I want you to read with me now, starting at verse 35. All of these questions have been asked. How many was it? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 questions have been asked in 34 verses. And listen to this. Jesus heard that they had thrown out the blind man. And when he found him, he said, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" In verse 36, the blind man responds and says, "Who is he, sir?" If you're an underliner, underline that question. Who is he? The man asked, "Tell me so that I can believe in him." And Jesus said, "You've seen him. In fact, you're now talking to him." And the man said, "Lord, I believe." And he worshiped him. And Jesus said, listen to his conclusion as to all the things that have happened. Jesus said, "For judgment I have come into this world, so that the blind will see, and those who see will become blind." And some of the Pharisees who were with him heard him say this, and they asked, "So here's your chance, Pharisees. You're standing there." And this blind man finally asked the right question. It's not about how he did it. It's not about how he's going to take care of me. It's not how the future is going to turn out. It's not what he's going to do. It's who are you? And when he asked that question, his life was changed from that point on. And so now the Pharisees are still standing around. They've heard this interaction. They've heard the right question. It's time for them to ask just one more question. Jesus, or they say, some Pharisees who were with him heard him say this, and they asked, "What? Are we blind too?" They still miss it. And Jesus said, "If you were blind, you would not be guilty of sin. But now that you claim that you can see, your guilt remains." And that's exactly what they did. "Hey, we know what happened here. We see it. You're a sinner from birth. Now get out. We have the answer. We know how it happened. We know all the answers to life. Now here's the thing. Let me apply this to us. Because oftentimes we're like the blind man. Oftentimes we're like the parents. And oftentimes we're like the Pharisees. And we got to figure out where we're going to land. And who we're going to be, and the kind of faith we're going to have. And for the parents, it was a faith of, I'm not going to land anywhere. Right? A lot of people have that kind of faith. It's a faith that says, "No, don't talk to me. Don't bring me into this. I don't want a part of this. I'm not going to take a side. I'm not going to have faith. I'm not going." And then you have the Pharisees who say, "I am going to find the answer. And I'm going to answer all of the questions. And all of the how it's going to work out, and what happened, and how God's working, I'm going to figure it all out. And I know the right way, and everybody else is wrong." And then you had a blind man who said, "I don't know what's going on." By the way, can I read you another verse of this blind man? Check out this verse. Verse 25. He said, the blind man, "Whether he is a sinner or not, I don't know, but one thing I do know, I was blind, but now I see." Right? I don't know how it happened. I don't know what was going on, but one thing I know, I was blind and now I see, and I want to find out who is the one who can heal me. And that's the question, folks, that we've got to start asking in our situations. Amen? Folks, like I said at the beginning, the ability to live confidently today is not in seeing the future, but is seeing who is in control of it. The ability to turn our nation to God, to live through a pandemic, to be the father I want to be physically, emotionally, spiritually, and mentally healthy, is not found in seeing the future, but it's found in who is in control of that future. Horatio Spafford was a well-known lawyer, and he was a businessman in Chicago. And this was in the 1860s. And he lived there with his wife and five children. And he invested in real estate all along the shores of Lake Michigan. So he was prosperous, and he was a great man, a great Christian man. But in 1870, events happened to Horatio that changed his life forever. His only son died of scarlet fever when he was only 4 years old. And so he and his wife are just distraught and they're grieving. And not 1 year later, the great Chicago fire breaks out and burns down almost all of his investments. And so all of a sudden, his life savings and his wealth that he had built is gone, and his son is dead. And so, aware of the toll that this was taking on his wife Anna and on his four daughters, he wanted his family to take a vacation, to get away. And so he decided to send them to England. And he was going to go, and they were going to go in a company. You remember Dwight L. Moody, D.L. Moody, on one of his great crusades? And so that was the plan. However, just before they set sail, a last-minute business situation came up for Horatio. Well, Horatio didn't want to ruin the trip for his wife and his kids. They really needed this time away. And so he said, you go on, and you set sail, and you head to England, and I will stay here in Chicago. I'll finish up the business, and I will come and meet you up as soon as I'm done. And then we'll have a good time together as a family. And so Anna and his four daughters boarded the French ship called the Ville du Havre, and they headed for England. And that's when, several days later, Horatio received devastating news that their ship had been struck by an iron sailing ship from England. And the ship sank within 12 minutes. And 226 passengers died. It was the worst disaster in naval history until the sinking of the Titanic some 40 years later. And the next day, he received a telegraph from his wife Anna that read, "Survived alone, what should I do?" All four of his daughters had drowned, and the next day he set sail to go to be with his grieving wife Anna in England. And during his voyage, the captain called him to the deck and said, "A careful reckoning has been made, and I believe we are now passing the very place where the Ville du Havre sank." And it was there, staring into the watery grave of his daughters, that he penned the words to the song, "It Is Well With My Soul." I want you to stand and sing this with me. When peace like a river attendeth my way, when sorrows like sea billows roll, whatever my lot, thou hast taught me to say, it is well, it is well with my soul, it is well with my soul, it is well, it is well. My soul, my sin, oh, the bliss of this glorious thought. My sin not in part, but the whole, is nailed to the cross, and I bear it no more. Praise the Lord, praise the Lord, oh my soul, it is well with my soul, it is well, it is well with my soul,
And Lord, haste the day when the faith shall be sight. The clouds be rolled back as a scroll. The trump shall resound, and the Lord shall descend. Even so, it is well with my soul. It is well with my soul. It is well. It is well.
You may be seated.
Amen.
Folks, that is an example of a man who could see. That is the example of a man who was asking the right questions. That is what it looks like to have faith in your darkest moment. A man who had lost his family and is sailing over the place where his daughters have died, has lost his son and lost everything. And yet, it's well with my soul. Not because of how it's working out, that's for sure. But because of who's still in control. And I love this line. I've sung this song. I love this song. So many years I've sang this song. And I saw a line that stood out to me more than it ever has before in the third verse where he says, "And Lord, haste the day when the faith shall be," what? Haste the day when I can see how and why and what. Haste the day where my faith will be a faith where I can see and I can answer all of the questions that all of those other people were asking. But then he keeps going. And he talks about where the clouds will be rolled back as a scroll and the trump shall resound and the Lord will be descend. And I can have all of those answers. But even so, it's well with my soul. Even when I can't see, even when I don't have the answers, it's well with my soul because I know who you are. And switching your how from your who can change your life. And the hard truth is this, folks. Sometimes God's going to allow us to be blind so that we can finally switch our question and see. Did you catch that in our text? He says, Jesus said, "For judgment I have come into this world so that the blind will see and that those who see," you think you see, you think you have all the answers, you think you know all the stuff, you see, he says, "those who see will become blind." He didn't just come to relieve those who are blind and help them to see, but to help those who think they see to become blind. And sometimes this is the harder truth for us, isn't it? That God may have to cause us to be blind in how things work out, in why he's doing what he's doing, so that we can ask the right question. See, there's another story, other than Horatio, of another man who is asking questions. And this is a story of a man who was persecuting Christians. And he was dragging them out of their homes. And he was killing them. And he thought that he was doing the right thing. He thought that he knew how to serve the Lord, but he had never stopped to ask the question, who is the Lord? And so God had to step in and had to take away a sight on the road to Damascus. But watch what happens to him. Look at Acts chapter 9. We're just going to start in verse 1. Meanwhile, Saul was still breathing out murderous threats against the Lord's disciples, and he went to the high priest and he asked him for letters to the synagogues in Damascus so that if he found anyone who belonged to the way, any Christians, whether men or women, he might take them as prisoners to Jerusalem. But as he neared Damascus on his journey, suddenly a light from heaven flashed around him. And what we know is that it caused him to go blind. And he fell to the ground, and he heard a voice say to him, "Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me?" And I think for the first time ever, look at how Saul responds. "Who are you, Lord?" Saul asked. For the first time ever, his question shifted from how he was supposed to do things and how it was going to work out onto who is over his life. And he recognized, "You're the Lord, I just don't know who you are." And Jesus responds and says, "I am Jesus." It gets even worse for Saul, though, because "I am Jesus, the one you are persecuting." And when Saul shifted his question from how to who, his life was never the same. Folks, it so changed him that he even changed his name from Saul to Paul. His complete identity was switched because he switched his perspective. And what it took for him was blindness to cause him to see like never before. And sometimes God has to say, "I'm not going to show you how it's going to work out. I'm not going to show you why it happened. I'm not going to give you the answer to why you're going through what you're going through. Because I am hoping to set you free, to be able to see in a way you've never seen before. And I know it hurts, and I know it doesn't make sense, and I know you're scared of the future. But your key to being confident in today is not in seeing the future. It's in placing your faith over the one who's in control of your future." And if we could just switch our sight and switch our perspective and switch our question onto who is in control, we will unlock a secret. Paul calls it a secret of contentment. And it will set us free. So I want to ask you the same question that we started with. If you had just one superpower, what would it be? And I hope that if you were like me and you thought, you know, seeing the future would be pretty nice, hopefully you switched it after this miracle. And that your wish is not to see the future, but if you have one choice of a superpower that you would choose to have, faith. Faith that could move mountains. A faith that will help you to pray like you've never prayed before to the God who is in control of your life. To parent with eyes of faith to the God who is in control of your life. To handle sickness of loved ones, whether mental, physical, emotional, or spiritual sickness. Trusting in a God who is in control of their life like never before. And if you do, folks, here's what I believe wholeheartedly. You're going to find yourself in the midst of some miracles soon. Think about it. If you need to respond, won't you come while together we stand and sing?